It's based upon a few lines in the 1640 edition of The Advancement and Proficience of Learning by Francis Bacon. In this particular quotation, he tells us that we are dependent very heavily upon the passing of the lamp, the motion of the lamp from generation to generation, and that a group called the Sons of Sapience, or the Sons of Wisdom, are the custodians of the lamp. And as long as humanity continues to serve the truth, or seek the truth, or keep the rules and laws of proper lineage, these Sons of Wisdom will pass on the lamp, and truth will not fail upon the earth. At this particular season, it seems that it might be appropriate to consider some of the points that seem to underlie Lord Bacon's statement. Who are the Sons of Sapience? According to him, they are those who have, from the beginning of time, carried forward the progress of humankind. Therefore, they belong to this mysterious order which never fails, never reveals itself, is never exposed, but continues quietly in the peace of its own inner life to perpetuate the virtues of humankind. Most people have never heard of such a person or persons as these Sons of Sapience. But they bring into focus a very interesting problem, namely that the individual has two biographies. Each of us, whether we realize it or not, has two stories of himself. The first of these stories is the one that begins with birth in this world, or perhaps shortly before birth, and continues through the years of life to the end. And this is the little biography that most of us know about. If this biography happens to be important, it will go into the encyclopedia. It will go into the family records. It will be remembered by the children and the children's children. And fame will accompany this person through the years of his life and through the years that follow his passing on. This is the one line of living that we are acquainted with. It is this line of living that we try to perpetuate. We do everything possible to be at least a constructive member of the society in which we exist. We hope to have a certain fame. We hope to gain distinction. We even hope to gain wealth, which is one of the most perishable of all assets. But we are also very much aware of ourselves in this little span of time. We have very little concept or idea or thought about anything outside of that. We believe that when we depart from this life, we will leave our possessions to our heirs and issues. We will not have any further part of it, and as far as the average person is concerned, he has no concept of what might be happening to himself after he leaves here. It is all very dim, because this little life that we know, as defined in the Shakespearean line, is surrounded by a sleep. We all go to some rest we know not where. We go to a mysterious future. Socrates refers to it also. He said that when he left here, he would either go to a better life than he had ever known, or he would cease and would have no further existence in time or eternity. So this is the way we live. We live within a philosophy of life that is bounded by birth and death. We live in the hope that we will be useful, helpful, or maybe even been a benevolent factor in the society to which we belong. We try to build a reputation. We seek wealth and fame and distinction. We search for advancement in place, as Lord Bacon calls it, that we shall join those who are famous, a great physician we shall become, or a great legislator, or probably a great financier. Or we will own vast properties, and for these distinctions, we have a certain local celebrity. But what happens? When we lay down the body, these all fade out. Someone else has everything that was once ours. And while we leave these things to our issues, or to some philanthropy, or to some noble cause, we leave all behind and go forth into the unknown with no possession, no added physical addition to our lives. We have only one hope, that there is something within us that survives this transition. And even if it does, it can only take what we are. It cannot take anything that we have or which we have accumulated in this life. Now, against this one biography, there is another, a second biography that we very seldom think of, a biography that would imply that each one of us has an existence in eternity as well as in time. And this is a point that Bacon seems to be making, namely, that we have not only a little life rounded by a sleep, but we have a greater existence that becomes the biography of an evolving being going down through time and eternity, existing forever, and that this being is growing step by step, and what we call the life of the individual is only a moment in the existence of something greater, that there is within each of us something that survives, something that goes on to become part of this mystery of the sons of sapiens, the sons of wisdom. Actually, we have a biography that goes through hundreds of lives, but we have no remembrance of it here. We have no way necessarily of judging it, although occasionally glimmers may break through. But there is something in this larger biography that we must come to understand. We are not only born to live and die in this little body, but we have an existence outside of this body, an existence that creates bodies, that makes new forms for everyone that fades away. In Indian philosophy, this is called the rosary of Brahma. It is many, many beads strung on a single cord. And this single cord is life, and these beads are the embodiments that go on and on, to form a marvelous jewel in the diadem or in the great admittance of the royal or divine order of things. We have, therefore, to consider a little bit of what happens when we approach life from the standpoint of this larger existence, that this existence is just as much our biography as the little one that we live in day by day, that we come into this world not new, but old. We come out again at the end, not old, but forever new. Everything goes and grows, and every human being has a life measured in time and a life measured in eternity. It is the realization of this that becomes one of the great parts of our knowledge, the carrying on of the realization that we were the past, that we are the present, and we must be the future. We cannot say the past is dead because nothing is gone but shadows. The realities of the past still live, just as they always have. And the past lives in each of us. It lives in our attitudes, our temperaments, our beliefs, our convictions. We belong to the ages. We belong to the Stone Age. And if we look around us in society today, we will find that there are some who are still in the Stone Age, some in the Bronze Age, some in the Age of Gold or Silver, and some in the mysterious age of space that still lies before most of us. We are all of us part of a great growth, and this growth is marked in our blood, in our veins, in our nerves, in our arteries. We bring from the past all that we were, and we will pass on to the future all that we are. All these things are part of one story of life, a story which, if we understand it better, may inspire us to live it better. We can always hope that the more we understand, the more rapidly we can grow and become part of this great plan of things. We are thinking so much now about the becoming of a new age, that the 21st century is approaching, that we are going into something new, and that we are preparing our children and hoping that they will prepare their children for this great transition in which we will step forward and the great ladder of evolution. But let us not forget that we are also going to be there when it happens. Whether we're alive in this world or not, we will be alive in the next century. We will find new vestments, new bodies, to take on the various attitudes we have developed here. If we have been selfish here and never grown better, then we will be selfish then. We will have all the same attitudes that we have today. And as we change these attitudes and outgrow them, we move forward into a better future. The better future is merely a new time in which to grow, and that growth must go on forever. Now the problem comes in, what do we mean when we say growth must go on forever? Do we have no rest? Have we no place of peace? Must we continually grow forever and ever? Yes, I think probably we do. But as we grow wiser, growth is no longer painful. So finally, growth becomes fulfillment. It becomes the thing we want more than anything else in the world, because we have discovered the truth that growth is the outgrowing of limitation and not the outgrowing of life. We will continue to live. We will be happier. We will be wiser, more useful. We will understand more of the great mystery of life to which we belong as we grow wiser. Therefore, to go on forever means to grow forever. And in the last analysis, the greatest of all happiness in life is to grow, to go on to new worlds, new horizons, new concepts. But we must always take with us the baggage of the old. We must take with us all the unfinished business that we have gone through in the past. Somewhere in the ancient times, we were the Medes and the Persians. We were the Greeks and the Romans. And we go back to the early people of Gondwana land, Atlantis, and Lemuria. We are all these people. They live in us now. We are them. Because this world is not made up of an endless group of new lives. It is made up of a sequential, a development of a certain species of being, born and brought up and in the wisdom of the divine mystery. Therefore, we are always growing as ourselves. But we are outgrowing the little self that we now cherish and try to defend. We are outgrowing the small beginnings to something larger. We are growing forever like the chambered nautilus. We are forever fulfilling. And in fulfillment comes the final happiness and the final wisdom to go on to the divine work which we were intended to do. Somewhere in the fields of space, we must sow and reap. Somewhere in the eternity of things, we must come closer and closer to the divine principle. And in coming closer to that, we become closer to the hearts and souls of those who need us. And we become, in truth, the sons of wisdom, the sons of sapience, who become the brothers, the custodians, the friends, and the protectors of the other lives that are coming up around us, the lives of other creatures, the lives of other kingdoms. They're all somewhere and sometime, and we will all, in fullness of life and fullness of realization, fulfill the purpose for which we were originally fashioned. So with this realization working in us, there comes to us an idea of Bacon's concept of the two biographies. The biography of the individual in this life and the realization that this biography is an instant, one page, in a great document that goes on as it has always gone on, from the beginnings and from the ends of things. Now this brings us another important situation to measure. We as we are today are not just people born now. We are not here to gain everything from our ancestry, or to become the utter victims of our environment. We are our environment. We have created it. It is the rung of the ladder where we now stand. It is the place which we have reached. And within each of us is all of our past. And within each of us is the realization of the need for all of our future. We are therefore living constantly in a growth that is being nurtured from our ancient experiences and which is being moved forward to the future that is still unborn. We also have to realize that in this mysterious procedure, we have within ourselves a vast body of knowledge, a tremendous group of facts, which perhaps when they occurred were not understandable. We're having the same thing today. We are in the midst of an emergency of nations. We are in the midst of a critical situation arising from the misunderstandings and misapplications of the principles of life. Therefore, we have to realize that within ourselves are locked all of the experiences that have gone before. Everything that has ever happened to us is there somewhere. We do not have a conscious memory of it, but we have a mind of it outside of body. And these wisdoms that we have learned, these lessons that still remain unlearned, are all part of the assets and liabilities of unfolding and evolving human life. So we have this now to go into the part that we have in the past. What are we bringing forward? Are we bringing forward the wonders of the arts and sciences of antiquity? Are we the wonders of Egypt, the wonders of India, the wonders of China? What have we brought forward with us, locked in us? Well, we have brought exactly what we earned. We have passed through certain experiences, and we carry forward our own reactions to these experiences. When we were Chinese, we were good Chinese, medium Chinese, and bad Chinese. And the medium and the badness does not mean that that is peculiar to China. A bad disposition can cut through all race and all time and remain until it is corrected. So we have all kinds of unlearned lessons, partly learned ones, and lessons that we have not even met yet. There are things we must do that we never heard of. There are things we have done we would like to forget. It is all part of this plan. It is a wonderful plan for one mystery of alchemy, namely that no living thing that comes into existence can ever fail. It may fail by the day, but by the age it succeeds. It may not make this particular adjustment in a certain life or in a dozen lives, but in a thousand lives it will arrive. All these things mean that we are building something, and that our little life here is not something that ends with a marble stone in the cemetery. It does not mean that our reputation will be carried by our descendants, and we will be judged good or bad according to public mind. All of the things that happen are part of a plan. Every mistake is as valuable as every virtue. The only problem is that we must keep on building the virtues and keep on correcting the mistakes. If we do this, the whole purpose of life develops. And we suddenly live in a vast unity of life. We live in a magnificence inconceivable. Now, some will say, as some of the scientists have said, that all this sounds very unreasonable for the sake of the fact that we have no evidence of some of these things. But then ask ourselves, what evidence do we have that there is any particular reason for living at all? If we are living on a planet that is all gradually going to disintegrate, and we are part of that planet, we will disintegrate with it. Certainly this is not an example of divine economy. It is a waste of everything. Also, it may be said of some of these problems that they are unsolvable, or that we must wait until they solve themselves, or we must elect proper leadership to make these corrections for us. We've tried that. It's not been an eminent success up to the present time. But we know that in this little bottle, which we call the planet, we live and move and have our beings. There is no evidence that we're going to move to another star. There's no evidence that a planet somewhere is being upholstered to receive us gently. We are going to face into the problem that we are on one little ball in space. We have done everything we could possibly do to ruin that ball. We have done everything we could to put all the emphasis upon now, that we must get every cent we can get now, that we must get all the fame and distinction now, that we must fulfill all our appetites, good, bad, or indifferent, now. But this doesn't seem to make much sense either. For the now goes down into the past and all is silence. There is therefore no explanation for man's existence if it all ends in some cemetery. There must be something else. We've also tried the ideas of heaven and hell. They've not been very popular either. They haven't solved very much. We are nearly always condemned by the judgment of our neighbors who don't like us. We have been condemned by religion, by science, by art, by culture. No matter what we do, someone differs. So there's not much solution there. The solution is that we are now carrying within us the wisdom of thousands, maybe millions of years. And we have refused to receive it. We've refused to acknowledge that we are a moment in a vast life much greater than we understand. We are afraid to admit that we are the past. And we are almost afraid to admit that we may be the future, because we are very dissatisfied with the fact that we are the present. All of these things become part of the philosophy of the of ones that are called the sons of sapiens, the ones who carry on the realization of the sublime purpose that is behind all of these changes that seem so infinitesimal or unreasonable. Now one will say, what proof have we of these changes? Why, what evidence do we have of what I've just said? The evidence, of course, is relative, but one thing, let bear in mind. If there is any excuse for our existence at all, if there is anything more to us than a dash of protoplasm, then our present philosophies are inadequate. There is no way to justify the human being being part of a practical universe unless something about the human being is practical. To have a world in which dead things are born and dying forever and never going anywhere, actually. Always in slavery to something. Always fighting for freedom. Always killing each other for liberty and enslaved by our own liberties. These things we have to know. What is the problem? I think Bacon sums it up in the simple problem. Is there a reason for existence, or is there no reason for existence? It is as simple as that. Either there is a reason for us, or there is no reason for us. And we cannot believe that a universe that would fill the heavens with solar systems, would fill the Milky Way with countless universes, has no reason for existence. That it is all one grand accident, and we are merely little accidents in the big one. It doesn't make sense. We cannot justify the laws of physics, the laws of biology, the laws of chemistry, the laws of music and art on the idea that we are in a series of accidents, a series of incidents, that our existence depends entirely upon the whims of our ancestors, and that there is no reason for anything. Bacon felt out that it was necessary, therefore, to learn to understand the passing on of the lamp. One of the most interesting symbols of that appears in the work on emblems by a Dutch philosopher, a humorist, an essayist, Father Cots. Father Cots lived in the 17th century, and he wrote a book on all the mysteries of symbolism, and he made pictures of these truths under some symbolic form, because you can't represent them completely abstractly. And in one of these, there is a picture of an old man with a hood and robes standing by the side of an open grave, and he has in his hand a lamp, and he is passing the lamp over the grave to a young man on the opposite side of the grave. And he is passing on the lamp. He is passing on light. He is passing on the most valuable thing in the world, light. Now, this is not just the light of the sun, or maybe it is the light of an invisible part of the sun. But this light that he is passing on is the key to the reason for existence. To pass on the light, to pass on from generation to generation, growth, fulfillment, release, and obedience. That the greatest of all wisdom is to obey the infinite plan of things, and to learn to obey that plan by gradually releasing our own experience. Now, back of each of us is enough experience to prove what our mistakes do to us and what our virtues do for us. We are constantly surrounded by evidence, and a certain amount of it comes through to us as intuition. There is a certain wisdom that comes out of the subconscious of ourselves. And, of course, we block that subconscious if, in our conscious life, we do not permit the wisdom of the things that are in this deeper part of our own understanding. While we believe in war, the experiences of ages of peace locked within ourselves cannot be released. We know we can't release ourselves from war by literal history. We've had thousands of wars and the peace is not yet, because we have not found out the true way of achieving this peace. Now, we think we're going to elect officers to do it. We're going to have changes of politics. We're going to have all kinds of improvements. But the one thing that we forget is that the truth about the matter is already inside of us, and always has been. We have just blocked the ability to be ourselves by compromising every principle that we have for a little profit in a shadowy world. We do not permit the best part of ourselves to come through. We cannot understand or accept that there is nothing but one family, that we are all brothers and sisters, that we are all part of one vast family working through space for a destiny which is locked in the will and wisdom of deity. So we have to begin to understand these things. But the moment we have a reverse, the moment a relative is no longer a friend, we lose faith in the universal brotherhood. These things are just simply part of our own inability to rise above the commonplace reactions which we have set up as standard. He didn't treat me well, so I'll treat him badly. This seems to be the idea of universal justice. That both might treat each other good has not been given much consideration. It's not believed, because we do not live that way. But in every one of us is locked the brotherhood of man, the fatherhood of God, and the future of the world. We have to find these things. And if we do not find them, then we will fail to make the adjustments that are necessary. We know now exactly what the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, and on centuries are and should be. We know exactly what is necessary, but we do not know that we know. And we have gradually come to trust all of our fate upon the thing that has no substance at all, and that is what we might call environmental circumstances. We are trusting upon the mistakes of each other, hoping to grow by maintaining certain mistakes that seem pleasant at the moment. But it's not going to work that way. There is already a reality. Man has never been left in this world without a teacher or without a proper key to his own future. The individual has locked within himself the integrity that he cannot find in society around him. He is capable of making the decisions that are necessary for his own growth. And each human being has a little different growth to face and a little different decision to make. But he doesn't need to have someone tell him what it is. It is in himself, if he will allow that which is the wisdom of the inner self to take dominance over the ignorance of the outer self. This transmission must be made by the person himself. And he is given every opportunity to make it. We have not a day go by except we realize the danger of narcotic addiction, the dangers of alcoholism, the dangers of cancer, and all the other problems, and all the social, economic, and political problems of mankind. We know them. We live with them every day. And in our souls and hearts, we know the answer. But we are locked in an environment in which we have given the exterior complete power over the interior. We live only to prove that we are alive today. How we live, what we think, what we do, is no time for consideration. We are in this particular place. We are surrounded by our debts and our liabilities. We are constantly agitated by the fears of war, poverty, disease. And being locked within this little cocoon, so to say, this little prison cell, we've come to one of the emblems of one of the great emblem masters. It shows a human skeleton seated in a rather jaunty posture. That's now. That's the way we are. And inside of the rib cage is the weeping virgin, the soul. The soul locked in the rib cage of bones, locked in the physical body, which imprisons it because it refuses to accept a life outside of it. Or even if it accepts it, it does so dimly. But when pain comes, an ache comes, or a sacrifice is required, it takes refuge in its own mistakes. This is the mystery, probably, of the Brotherhood of Sepians. Now, from the beginning, and we find this in all the religions and teachings of mankind, there have been certain persons. Who they are, what they are, we may never know. But from the beginning, we were given instructors. When we were little children in the great history of the world, we had parents who taught us. Later, we had school-based people to teach us. And little by little, we have developed from them the great systems of learning, which have their foundations in integrity. These have descended to us mostly through the great philosophies and religions of mankind. They come not only in religion and in philosophy, but they are subject to the adulteration of themselves because they have to pass through this consciousness that is locked in materiality. Therefore, our religions become fanatical. Our philosophies become materialistic. The great dreams that we have are lowered until finally all we can really think about is one step forward in our own industrial accomplishment. But the Brotherhood of the Sepians, those who have lived and those who have wisdom, has come down to us. There isn't a single problem that we face today that we have not faced before. There is not one of these problems that we did not answer reasonably well. And there is not one of these problems in which the answers have not faded away because the individual becomes locked more and more in the immediacy of fame and fortune. As soon as it becomes a problem of sacrificing a mistake in honor or in credit of something better, we hesitate. The mistake is perhaps to cling to the sins we have. This is not a very solutional situation. We can try everything but a cure, and then nothing will work but the cure, and we are afraid to try that. So out of it all comes a series of dependencies, a series of compromises, and we are now heading into a compromise for the new century. Lots of folks now are deeply concerned in the building of the 21st century. We hope tremendously that we're going to solve problems. We hope desperately that we're going to get through to that new century without another war, without further bloodshed, and without further tragedy. And yet every day as we read what happens to nations, we are also reading of what happens inside of the skin of each individual. The selfishness, The abandonment of integrities that is now cursing the world is also cursing us because we are the source of it. It isn't the heavens that made selfishness. It is man. It isn't the heavens that give peace. It is man. It is the people and creatures that we have fashioned that must carry on the work that still remains to be done. So in this particular type of thinking, we already have the answer. Nature is giving us a little nudging now and then. Nature is very wise because nature has a little remedy when we don't behave ourselves. When we get too far out of line or get too arrogant or self-centered or ambitious, we set up in society a pattern that destroys us or makes us so miserable we can't live with it anymore. So we have a choice. When we have made a mistake and tried to live with it and we can't stand it any longer, we have two choices. Just continue to try and live with it till it destroys us, or change it and survive. If we do not solve a problem, it will curse us till we do. And if we never solve it, we will never have the peace that solution can bring. Nature is very particular about these things. Absolutely just. It has never failed to reward according to the virtues and integrities of the occasion. And it will never fail to do that. So we have the importance to give the universe and our own inner lives an opportunity to exist. Now, when we have our own inner lives, what are we talking about? Well, someone says, well, there's a spirit probably living in there somewhere. Or maybe we have a soul. Or perhaps we have a mind that governs bodies. Or perhaps we have a body that dictates to mind and all the rest. We have all kinds of things under the earth. But what we may not recognize is that we have an eternity under there. An eternity which gave birth in the beginning to time. And time now, which must someday give birth again to eternity. We have within ourselves every necessary element for the solution of any problem that we can ever face. But we can't quite get through to it. And when something else comes along and we find that our solution is interfering with our pocketbooks or interfering with some ambitions that we have, we hesitate. And we cling to the ambitions and we cling to the pocketbook and they are buried with us. We have got to get to the point where we are stronger than our own weakness. And in order to be stronger than our own weakness, we must transcend the temptation to put the small thing first and neglect the greater thing entirely. So we have at this moment another challenge. How are we going to meet this next century that comes along? What are we going to do about it? Are we going to move in there with exactly the same things we have now? Are we going into the 21st century with the narcotics problem unsolved? Are we going in with crime still rampant? Are we going to go in it with all kinds of ulterior motives, selfishness, self-centeredness, arrogance, and just generally bad disposition? Or are we going to try to do something about it? Now, everyone would like to do something about it. So the next problem is that we must elect some representative and give office to him so that he can take care of us. We've been doing that for a long time, and he find out in the end that the only thing he's taking care of is himself. This in itself is obviously wrong. There can be no remedy to the present situation until integrity in the individual is strong enough to overcome the temptations which now dominate him. Without integrity, there can be no advancement in civilization. If we do not have the courage and wisdom to do what is right, we will not have the courage and wisdom to follow some person we elect, even if he is trying to do what is right. We will drag him down. He will not lift us up. We've got to support the things that we believe to be true. We've got to gradually, quietly work out our own adjustment to life. It will be a little different for each of us. In some cases, our temptation is one thing, in some cases, it's something else. And according to our achievements, certain temptations will come into focus in this lifetime, and certain will have to wait. But if we want to be any better than we are now, we've got to let betterness come out from ourselves and not try to impose it upon ourselves by means of federal or world governments and laws. He cannot make a man honest by control of law. You must make him honest by control of himself. And this can be done because we have been given every instrument necessary. We have been given every opportunity, and we have been provided with every evidence of the emergencies which will result if we do not make these adjustments. We have seen two great wars in our own century. We have seen misery, and we have seen it go on. We have seen that we are now doing business with those we fought 50 years ago, and in 50 years now, we will be doing business with those we are fighting with today. It will go on and on. The only answer is honesty. The only answer is the recognition that we live in a beautiful world and that we are destroying it. And that this destruction is not going to be overlooked by natural law. As an individual disobeys the laws of his body long enough and systematically enough, he gets sick and dies. If he makes better care of himself, he lasts a little longer. And it is the same way with society. The better society becomes, the longer it will last, and the more serviceable will it be. All these things are simply matters of integrity. And nature has one primary objective. It is going to enlighten us if it's the last thing we do. And if we become enlightened, it's the last thing we need to do. So it's an opportunity for all of us to come to be included in this title of the Sons of Sapiens, the Sons of Wisdom. These Sons of Wisdom have in little ways, according to their own insights, discovered one or two of the fragments of reality. They have discovered the importance of peace. They have become importance of idealism, of integrity, of morality, of ethics. They have gradually created small central patterns, and their descendants and followers are living them today. We know the peace and brotherhood taught by Christ. We know the compassion taught by Buddha. We know the renunciation of error taught by Lao Tzu. We know obedience to the rules of peace as taught by Confucius. We also know the exact science of redemption as set forth by Pythagoras of Samos. These were the Sons of Sapiens who gave us rules. They are honored, and they are regarded as the great benefactors, but somehow we don't emulate them. We don't do the things that they taught us to do. Now, the same thing may happen to us. We may have certain ideals. We may teach them. We may do the best we can with them. And the great sea of indifference will close over it. But the fact that it is ignored or rejected has nothing to do with its validity. And in the end, the truth must rule. Other than that, we have no security, no hope of integrity, no hope of fulfillment. And in this universe in which everything is magnificent, even the simplest thing is a miracle. Even those that have little understanding live day by day by a wisdom they know nothing of. All these things are so real that we have the realization that it's quite possible for us to achieve more than we have achieved. Now we are in the midst of another social climax. We are now trying to figure out whether we can put off, at least indefinitely, the next world war. We are also hoping that in some way we will be able to get rid of the rubbish and refuse of the wars that have gone before. We hope we can save the world from the intoxication of toxins with which it has been afflicted for centuries. Realizing that we want to do these things, we are gathering to know how to do them. I think the answer is we have to, each one of us, take the time and the energy to study our own relationship to these things. I think one of the things we all have to do is build a solid foundation under our hope. We cannot really go out and do the things that are necessary unless we have some hope, some belief, some assurance that integrity survives, that there is something about it that will live on. Perhaps this is the greatest mystery of history. And we think of history largely now as a dry record of human mistakes. Well, it has taught that. But in history also is the thread of a glorious success. Within it also is the proof that that which is not right never succeeds, and that that which is not right perishes. But out of the ashes of that which is not right rises the phoenix of progress. Something new and better comes into being. There is a growth that is built upon pain, built upon misery, built upon selfishness, but it is all transmuted into a mysterious internal experience which may be very sad and very tired,